Mr. Jones and Mr. Anderson. Good morning.
Good morning. May I please report?
Please.
Attorney Jones with the Chesapeake Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Logan.
Would you like some rebuttal time, Mr. Jones?
No.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that the issue in the case was whether the trial court excluded, were all the reasonable conclusions inconsistent with guilt excluded by the trial court. And the I think my brief lays out pretty clearly that there were other individuals obviously in the home. There were numerous other children in the home that gave an opportunity for the injuries that Walia, the 16-month-old child, sustained.
Wasn't there medical testimony that pretty much excluded those other children from committing this type of injury?
Your Honor, I don't think so, because Dr. Gofton indicated that the skull fractures or the injuries were not, it was not determined of how those injuries really occurred or the amount of force that was applied for those injuries. And the children engaged in activities that demonstrated that they could have been the cause of the injuries.
But counsel, let me stop you. If I remember correctly, the testimony was that none of the children were jumping on the bed in the area where Walia was sleeping.
That's
correct. The medical testimony also indicated that the force needed to deliver the blows would have required it being an adult, and that nobody of the children would have been able to qualify in that category. Isn't that something that the trial court could have considered?
Yes, that is something that the trial court could have considered and did consider. I didn't have the benefit, obviously, of trying the case, but different adults are at different sizes and different abilities to apply force, and with the same token, different children are as well. The children were not at the same location as the child when the child was discovered on the bed. They were jumping apparently at the head of the at the other end of the bed while the child was at the head of the bed. But there was also other indications of rough housing by the children. And I believe the medical information...
But the child had been in the room with the appellant for several hours, and the testimony from one of the children was that when the child was delivered to the appellant's room, that the child was perfectly healthy and went in for a diaper change. I mean, so there is sort of a period of time where there's a categorization of her health and her status as being normal. So, I mean, how do you account for that in terms of your argument?
Well, I guess the absence of what's not there. There was no crying that was testified to by any witness on behalf of the child. And also, Mr. Logan was seen by one of the other children going in and out of that bedroom washing clothing throughout that day.
But Walia was not. She was not seen coming back out of the room until the children went in a little bit later on. Wouldn't that be correct? And aren't those factors that the trier fact could consider?
That is correct. But I think that obviously, you know, I didn't have the benefit obviously of trying the case, but I think that more weight could have been or should have been given to some of the other factors. And obviously, I know that an individual can be found guilty on a circumstantial case. It doesn't have
to
be direct.
Who determines the weight of the evidence, the appellate court or the trial court?
The trier of fact. I agree. But I think that the trier of fact should have given more weight to a lot of the other factors that were involved. There was CPS was already involved with the home, with the other children, with Amir, for example, and with two of the other children. So there was a lot of circumstances in the home that I think exhibited an atmosphere where there could have been some other cause of the injuries to the child.
Except for what about the medical testimony about the time frame in which those type of injuries would have shown up?
Well,
they wouldn't have occurred over an extended period of time, so how would you speak to that?
Well, the...
In terms of what the trier of facts weighing.
Right. I understand. Well, I think the medical testimony goes more so from the persons that they may have engaged as far as talking to, the police, the maybe the children that were involved in the case. And so we have to take that into account. Obviously, it's a credibility issue. And so if the medical testimony is based upon what they're getting from the testimony of the children, then they're taking that at face value that what the children said was correct. Mr. Logan, I did not think was shown to be not credible. He showed no motive in regards to wanting to cause any harm to the child. There was no indication that there was ever any specific intent on behalf of Mr. Logan to cause any injury to the child whatsoever. There was no premeditation, no deliberation that was ever shown on behalf of the Commonwealth that Mr. Logan would have had any reason to kill the child.
Well, counsel, you'd acknowledge that there is case law, including like the Epperly case, that talks about the fact that the trier fact can consider the disparate size of the victim versus the adult, the number of blows, the lack of remorse. Those are things and factors that the court can consider in terms of determining whether there is that element required for first degree. And, I mean, are you indicating that those factors were not present that the court could have considered?
Well, I'm not saying that those factors were not present, but I think that to the exclusion of motive, I think in this particular case, given how the whole circumstance of how all the events happened, that motive should have been a bigger factor, although motive is not necessarily a factor in the Epperly case, I understand that. But I think that motive should have been a bigger factor that the trial court should have weighed because it just was not present.
But motive is not necessary for finding a premeditation, is that fair to say?
That's correct. I agree, but I think that should have been an area where the trial court should have spent more time because the facts just laid out that Mr. Logan, he had gone to see the child after he had learned of a CPS investigation. And on the very day that the child unfortunately ended up deceased, Mr. Logan and the child's mother, they were scheduled to take the child to see Mr. Logan's family. So it just doesn't pan out that Mr. Logan was the one who had the specific intent.
How old are the children?
The children
They
range in ages from the younger child, 16-month-old, to 15 years of age, and then there was one older child, Marquand, who was 18 years of age. So, and they range in different sizes as well. And I think the Commonwealth made a point that Amir, who had behavior problems, that because of his size, that weighed into the court's decision that he could not have been the cause of the injury to the child. But at the same time, this same individual, Amir, was also seen chasing the other children with a screwdriver. So that's behavior that is not necessarily consistent with every child that may be of a small stature.
You're not suggesting that the nature and severity of these injuries were caused by roughhousing, are you?
Could have been. Yes, Your Honor. Could have been. It could have been.
But one of the doctors testified it couldn't happen that way.
But one of the doctors also indicated they did not know the amount of force that was used or what was the actual cause of the skull fractures.
And they did I don't remember which one, but the doctor did testify the force needed to cause these type of injuries.
I recall that in regards to a child being in a car crash. I agree with that. But at the same time, I did not think that there was a specific cause that was pointed out by a specific doctor as to what would have happened to the child. I just think there were just too many other children that were there that gave an opportunity for there to be another cause of the child's death. And at the time that Mr. Logan would have been in the room with the child, he testified. He certainly did not have to testify. He testified what he did in the room. He was watching television, changed clothing, and the child was asleep on the bed. And the only time that he, that was the time that he would have been in there with the child. He changed the child's diaper. The child went out with him, walked to the door with him. He released the child's hand there, and he didn't see the child anymore after that time. So there was nothing to, in my opinion, to come against his credibility versus the other witness's credibility. I understand this is the appellate court, but I just believe that the trier of fact should have weighed a lot of the other areas differently than it weighed in this case. I just thought that there were just other opportunities for someone else to have been the cause. And certainly in regards to the other charge, the abuse regards to the child, suspicion is not enough for someone to be convicted of that charge. If there's some other person that is there to show that they had an opportunity to cause the injury, then I think that lends more to my client's point that he was not the one who caused the injury to the child.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court again. This is obviously a fact-driven case, as shown by the fact that my brief, the argument began on either page 20 or 21, and I would posit that I could probably stand up here for 30 minutes without interruption and go through relevant facts. Obviously, I can't do that, so let me highlight.
First of all, you couldn't get away without us interrupting you.
Well, no, but the part of the positing was that for some inexplicable reason, you would permit me to talk for 30 minutes while I went through my facts. If we allow for questioning, then we'll move it up to 45 or 50 minutes. Now, obviously, for this court, the only ultimate question is whether a reasonable jurist could have found this evidence sufficient. Not necessarily what some other reasonable jurist might have concluded. And also on the issue of premeditation.
Counsel, let me interrupt here. I hate to do it so early in the argument, but maybe to focus in reference to the premeditation element in Rhodes. I think that's one of the cases that the appellant cited in support of that. Would that case not support his position that there was a lack of premeditation? Because there was a clear injury in that particular case. There was clearly the opportunity for that particular parent to have been the one to have perpetrated it, but the court found that there was not premeditation shown by the Commonwealth. If you would address that.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. If Rhodes is his main argument for why this evidence fails, then that's an awfully slender read. Again, premeditation is an issue of a fact, a finding of fact, like any other finding of fact. On appeal, it's enforceable if there's fair support in the record for it, or it's not plainly wrong. In this case, manifestly, it's not plainly wrong. In Rhodes, for example, the evidence was that the defendant had been seen as crying, distraught, hysterical, and fainting. In this case, it was the mother who was described in those terms, not the defendant. The police officer who responded said that Logan, quote, seemed to be quiet. Now, admittedly, he then, with the horse gone out the barn and knowing what's about to maybe blow up in his face from having murdered this little 16-month-old, he then attempts to administer CPR, which is obviously far too little, far too late. I know that a case I cited, which I submit, as discussed in brief, is much closer factually to this case. This is at page 28 of my brief, Knight v. Commonwealth.
In Knight, there was the acknowledgement from the defendant in that particular case that the baby was crying and that he had struck the child a couple times. Isn't that absent in this particular case?
Well, this defendant certainly made a number of inconsistent statements before and during trial that the trial judge was well aware of. Again, each case by definition rises and falls with its own facts. In that particular case, I mean, we're talking about Knight now.
Yes.
In that particular case, there was evidence that the defendant had attempted to conceal his role in his daughter's death. He'd given numerous accounts of what had happened. There were, the evidence was in conflict about whether he was upset. And this is the point I started to make from Knight. The Court of Appeals said the record supported the finding that his, quote, emotions were the result of concern for his own predicament and not regret over his actions. I submit that the trier of fact could have concluded the same here as to the CPR. Let me, since I can't possibly go through every relevant fact, let me just point out a couple of things that seems to me a reasonable jurist could give heavy reference to. One, and there was a lot of medical evidence here by two different doctors, and the evidence here virtually removes any question about the fact that the one and only adult during the relevant time frame in this home was the defendant, Logan. By the way, there were six children in the home in that same time frame. Four of them were 10 or younger, and I've gone through medical records indicating just how physically slight a number of them were. And I would submit that their slight stature and youthful age virtually by definition precluded the possibility that they could have committed such brutal crimes. But again, that's important. He's the only adult there during the time frame. Dr. Clayton testified that the injuries to the little girl's chest, quote, were patterned, meaning they had a characteristic size and shape that was typical of an adult's fingertips and knuckles. That's at page 262 of the appendix. The trial judge specifically alluded to that evidence at page 971 of the appendix and convicted. This is the only person that fits that medical description. Also, another thing I think a reasonable jurist, certainly if I were that reasonable jurist, I'd give it tremendous weight. You have the EMT people and the police are dispatched something like 3:57 p.m. to the house and arrive shortly thereafter. The defendant tells Jenkins, who I think who was an EMT person, shortly just after 4 p.m., he had taken a nap with the little girl, and when he awoke, quote, found her like that, with the only thing that can mean is in the dire condition that she was discovered to be in. But then he tells Officer Ewell within 2, 3, 4 minutes either side of that, that he and the mother, Ms. Brown, were about to leave when one of the children ran out to say there was something wrong with Walia. Those statements are not even remotely reconcilable. They're made within minutes after the fact. They speak for themselves. And irrespective of the facts of any of these other cases, I think that is damning. Both of those things by themselves and collectively, I submit, speak for themselves. There's some assertion here that the defendant didn't have a motive to kill the little girl. Well, if you have someone whose bond is conspicuously lacking and who, at the very least, there's a pattern of hostility towards the child and the child a pattern of fear, then the distinction between that and motive, I submit, really largely evaporates. The defendant didn't even know until after the fact that Ms. Brown, one, was pregnant, and two, had given birth. He testifies at trial. He can't even give his dead daughter's birth date correctly. She was born in April of, I guess it was 2011. He said it was sometime in February. He hardly saw the child until 2 months before he moved in June of 2012. By August 2012, the child is dead. There was evidence in the weeks before she died that she, quote-unquote, whimpered if she had to go towards the defendant. One of the social workers, I forget her precise title, Ms. Wiley, it was to the point of having seen this that she joked with Logan that Walia didn't seem to like him. His response was basically something other than, what are you talking about? He said, well, she didn't seem to want to go to him unless he was feeding her. And then in the course of that day, when Markman, who I think counsel said was 18, my recollection is he was 15 at the time, but, and he was the oldest of the children, that when he went to the defendant's room because her diaper needed to be changed, well, Leah started crying as they approached the door, and then the defendant's response was something other than, okay, that's, yeah, I'd be glad to help out. It was, yeah, he, by his own description, didn't normally change the diapers, and there was this long pause. He said, well, okay, and he does it. He later told the police that Walia had a fussy disposition, and he would get mad when she was fussing or crying. Now, as to the children, again, four of them were 10 or younger. Most of them, the physical size virtually by definition ruled out the possibility that they could have killed this little girl in such a brutal fashion. The expert testified that for it to have been an accident, she gave two examples of an accident that could have accounted for the severity of these injuries. One is someone who's dropped several stories, as she emphasized, several stories from a building. The other is the car is going at some significant speed and an unrestrained person is tossed from outside. The notion that these little kids roughhousing at the other edge of the bed could account for this is something that, to put it mildly, a reasonable jurist wouldn't have to accept. The children, of course, given the fact there's no other adult at the time, are the convenient scapegoats, but besides their small size and stature, there are other reasons to exclude them. First, the defendant's own statement to the police said nothing untoward had happened that day, and he certainly wasn't making any claim, had no knowledge that any of the other children had done anything. It's a little late for him at trial and appeal to say, well, I didn't really mean that. The various children testified that they hadn't done anything and they hadn't seen anything by any of the other children. And this court, I think it was in, may have been in Rhodes, let me just, in Burnett. In Burnett, which is at page 34 of my brief, where there was an issue of whether the boyfriend might have been the villain. And this court, in part, relied upon the fact that the boyfriend had specifically testified he hadn't harmed the infant. Well, we have multiple children here giving equivalent testimony, plus the defendant's own statement exonerates them. So on the issue of premeditation, which again is a finding of fact, you have a brutal murder. Both the pancreas and the liver are virtually severed. You have other injuries to the body. You have three separate skull fractures, one of which was to a bone that was in such a place situated where it was difficult to even accomplish that. The trial judge made a quote-unquote credibility call against the defendant, considering his different versions of what happened, including his testimony trial disavowing certain of his prior statements. We were certainly supporting that. The defendant, according to the judge, for no real reason, didn't attend the viewing or the burial. He basically skipped town, even though he had promised to be available to the police for further questioning and to talk with the mother. Again, I can't possibly go through every fact that I think plainly supports the verdict in this case, but I submit that a reasonable jurist could plainly have found sufficient evidence of premeditation, specific intent to kill, and plainly found sufficient evidence of criminal agency. Whatever facts I haven't had time to mention now, I would urge the court to just review the statement of facts of the Commonwealth's brief, which I think is pretty comprehensive. If there are no other questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. We will come down and greet counsel. Thank you, Mr. Jones, Mr. Anderson.